for England and Wales by the middle of the afternoon. But for most of us on Sunday, it will be a cold start, more cloud around than Saturday, and the wind slowly increasing. But we could see a few showers cropping up into southern England ahead of the rain. Enjoy Saturday's sunshine.
Lovely, some sunshine before the rain returns. Louise, thank you very much. Louise Lear there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, Will Adamsdale reads the final part of The Telling Room by Michael Paternitti, in which the journalist finally learns the truth behind the scandal that brought down possibly the world's greatest cheese.
In the year after our return home, I sequestered myself and wrote, always concluding at those same end-of-summer scenes, shipwrecked as we share Ambrosio's last tin of cheese. My wife, Sarah, urged me to return to Guzman, to ask some direct questions. You need to put an end to this, she said. For some reason, this is what I seem to dread most, the path that led to the end, to a knock on Julian's door, like some muckraking journalist. Would it be open wide or slammed shut? Was he a despicable snake or someone else altogether? I packed my bag and found myself in Guzman again, the beautiful village on the hill, the familiar sights and smells flooding my senses. Ambrosio was Ambrosio, all enveloping in his welcome. When I worked up the gumption to ask after his lawyer as casually as I could, he seemed to hesitate, then said his name, Pascual Llopis. And his number, I asked. The shift between us was awkward and palpable, but he gave it to me. I wrote the phone number down on my hand. Ambrosio is a unique character, said his lawyer, triangling his fingers into a steeple. He sat behind a large leather-top desk in a beige suit and brown striped tie, with a neatly trimmed salt-and-pepper beard. He proclaimed that a man like Ambrosio was a bit of an endangered species in the New Spain. Then he told me a story. He talked about the time when, back in 1989, the cheese became the darling of the international cheese conoscenti. And yet, many had counseled Ambrosio, keep it small, everything in moderation. But Ambrosio had fallen under the spell of two local investors, Pedro and Teodoro, who were hungry to expand their portfolios and whose pitch seemed to match Ambrosio's grand vision for his cheese operation. Right from the start, with their initial contract, the fraud was in place, claimed the lawyer, Llopis. The investors promised to be Ambrosio's partners, but they have majority control of the company, two board votes to his one, and no legal or monetary exposure. Meanwhile, Ambrosio staked his entire patrimony on the company. He was the one who had his name on the contracts with the suppliers. It wasn't until the company was drained of money and unable to pay its debts that Ambrosio realized the implications of his signature on the partnership agreement and on the supplier contracts he'd signed alone. My client let himself, or got himself, tricked by a couple of guys without shame. But, I wondered, how in the world would Ambrosio allow himself to be so duped unless led into it by his best friend Julian, who was supposed to be checking such contracts? What gave Ambrosio confidence, said Llopis, was that there was tons of cheese in the bodega, stored and cured, and it was essentially like money in the bank. Knowing Ambrosio, he was saying to Julian and everyone else, don't worry, I got it. I found myself confused. Where was the big showdown with Julian in the office, the puta clutching his throat and emitting the liar's choking giveaway? Then Llopis said something with a bluntness that surprised me. When it comes to law and business, Ambrosio is a big zero. He understands nada. Llopis carried on. This is when we get to the big problem. Ambrosio has left the company, resigned, but he's still the owner of a third of the business, and all contracts are still with his name on them. All of a sudden, the shepherds, the delivery truck drivers, they aren't being paid. And they start to go after Ambrosio, because he's the one who's always paid them. There was a lot of aggression flying around. When I asked what he meant by this, he said, death threats. Shepherds were knocking on Ambrosio's door and threatening to kill his wife. The most painful part of all this was the loss of honor, Llopis explained. Some of these guys were friends of Ambrosio's from childhood, and he couldn't pay them. And the whole thing drove him crazy. His only legacy of his beautiful family cheese was the nearly $3 million of debt that was his alone to repay. The lawyer wasn't blaspheming or disparaging my friend. I believed him. Clearly, Ambrosio was no good with money or contracts. But what about the Julian I hadn't met? How did he justify having thrown everything away to be in cahoots with those two investors? But when I asked Senor Llopis about Julian, I was surprised. One thing is what Ambrosio supposes happened. Another was what the evidence is, he said. And we never had anything to go after Julian. Here's how I see it, said Llopis. There were these guys who saw this cheese business as a way to make a lot of money. Julian maybe knew them and presented them to Ambrosio. They started doing their thing on Ambrosio. Did they trick him? Yes. But to say that something was totally planned with Julian from the beginning against Ambrosio, highly unlikely. Julian might, I suddenly realized, be responsible, not for a terrible act of intent, but rather a mistake. These two guys pulled a fast one on him too, I think, knowing that he was Ambrosio's friend. Essentially, they duped both of them. But then, why hadn't Julian gone to Ambrosio and apologized? Wouldn't honesty and supplication have solved the matter between dear friends? It's one thing making a mistake, and another making amends, said Llopis. Remember, this man has his Castilian pride too. Julian would have lost his credibility as a lawyer, his career, his honor, everything. The other guys got the company, and Ambrosio got screwed. If I was honest, in the face of this information, my cheese book was dying a slow death. But the more dire things seemed, the more resolved I felt. My next trip back to Guzman came 4 months later, after Ambrosio's father passed away. He seemed older, hunched ever so slightly by the mantle that had been passed to him. To see him so vulnerable, so diminished now, made me want to believe in him again twice as much. Finally, I blurted out to him that I'd met with Llopis on my last visit, and I'd been struck by one thing, that there wasn't evidence to prove any wrongdoing on Julian's part. Ambrosio stared at his hands, then spoke quietly and without venom. Julian was still a dissembler, according to Ambrosio, but he wasn't a puta, exactly. I'd like to speak to him, I said. Ambrosio took a moment. Then, exhaling deeply, and after what felt like years of resistance, he said, fine, let's go find him then. We drove to nearby Aranda, where we were told we could find Julian at the courthouse. But what was I supposed to say to the man if we did find him? We screeched to a halt before the courthouse. Ambrosio said, wait here, and stalked through the glass doors. I sat in the car. Was this the ending? What was he going to do? Drag him out here by the ear? Shoot him? Ambrosio came back. The door flew open. Missed him. He fumbled for a cigarette. To his office, then. He parked the car in a nearby square. He gestured to a nondescript office block, then pointed to a bar. I'll wait in there. I gathered myself and approached Julian's building. I read his name in the directory, Julian Mateos. I rehearsed my lines. I have a few questions about the cheese, hombre. How could you? It wasn't often that a foreigner showed up in Aranda. Julian's curiosity must have been piqued, for I was soon shown in to see him. He was a tall man, with a full head of hair and a firm handshake. His handsomeness was disarming. He was neatly dressed, in collar and tie and blazer. His black lawyer robes hung in a corner. What brings you here? He said, smiling. I told him I was visiting the region for a book project. It's set in Guzman. Then I added I'd become good friends with Ambrosio Molinos. And at those words, Julian seemed to recede. But his fingers didn't grab for his throat, nor did he start to go, I'm writing a book about Páramo de Guzman. There are many stories about this cheese, and I thought I'd better come and hear yours. Yes, he said, gathering himself. Ambrosio is an old friend, or was. There's been a misunderstanding. Do you speak with him often? I've been hoping to have a conversation with him for years. I looked toward the window, knowing that the man himself sat in the bar below. I'll be seeing him tonight, I said. Would you convey a message then? Tell him I'd love to meet, to try and mend our friendship. I'd like to hear your side, I said. Bale, he said. He averted his eyes briefly. We can meet again, but I do not have time right now. We arranged to do so later, and I left. I went straight down to the bar and passed on Julian's message. Ambrosio descended into thought. Then he said, I loved him like a brother. A tear splashed on the tabletop. And another. Then he looked across the street, doing some internal calculation. He let out a deep sigh. Venga, he said. Let's go home. Some days later, I met with Julian in a bar in Madrid. He told me his story. In short, he explained, the investors were brought in because sales couldn't keep pace with expenses. The cheese was incredible, delicious, loved by kings and presidents, but it was caviar. And not everyone eats caviar. So Julian sought out more finance. The investors were friends of his who trusted him. Even with the infusion of cash, Paramo de Guzman continued its downward spiral. Julian saw less and less of Ambrosio. When the crisis came, Ambrosio didn't fight for the business. He filed for bankruptcy. He wanted out. The heretical sentence echoed in my head. He wanted out? Really? In this alternative telling, Ambrosio appeared in Julian's office, lamenting that his company had crashed. He wanted to declare bankruptcy. Julian immediately advised him not to do so because the bank would go after his personal assets. I told him it's better to find buyers because the product is good. Otherwise, the bank will take everything. Ambrosio refused. He needed an ending. I said to him, why don't we get everyone to sit down and find a way to harmonize the situation? And Ambrosio said, it's too late. There's nothing for us to talk about. And they hadn't spoken again for 20 years. Here, Julian shifted in his chair and winced. Everything comes and goes. Problems come and go, but losing Ambrosio's friendship is the thing that still hurts the most. He said to me he didn't want to go on like this. I offered. Julian nodded slowly. I always felt he had this desire. But you know, it became impossible because he built up this legend, this history of the betrayal of the best friend. But now, I'm beginning to suspect that time is undermining the legend. Ambrosio's aware that I'm talking to you, I said. So in a way, I'm a bit of a messenger. I'd entered the drama as the negotiator. I went back to Ambrosio. Julian would like to meet you if you're willing. He'd like for the two of you to put this behind you, and I think you would too. I waited, imagining the two men embracing. Then Ambrosio issued his final decision. No, he said. It's not possible to forgive that puta. The only thing Ambrosio Molinos had left, the only thing the banks couldn't take away from him, was his story. The offering to his father, the betrayal, the murder plot. Each time he told his legend, he became the righteous one again. He stood once more for something great, the immortality of the old Castilian. He needed this story in order to live with himself. This wasn't just Ambrosio. We all had our secrets, and maybe the most terrible of them was that we weren't exactly who we thought we were, who we said we were, who we dreamed of being, that we were all half-made of self-mythologies too. After so much time trying to uncover the truth, after searching for the cheese and finding it and tasting it at last, I didn't care who was right or wrong. If we couldn't believe in legends and a hopeful piece of cheese, what the hell was left in the world? The perfect narrative, the great philosopher Walter Benjamin once said, is revealed through the layers of a variety of retellings. And I had a feeling that this one was still being aged and perfected, even as I had reached my end with it.
Will Adamsdale was reading from The Telling Room by Michael Passanitti. The book was abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 11th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Etzira, South Etzira, Forties, Fitzroy, Seoul, Shannon, Rockall, Fair Isle, Faroes, and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low just south of Iceland, 986, expected southeast Iceland, 1002 by 1800 Saturday. New high expected France, 1024 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Etzira. Cyclonic 4 or 5 in far north, otherwise westerly, veering northwesterly 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Rain or showers, moderate or good. South Etzira, 40s.